Rosa Chao is Associate Professor of Philosophy at Stanford University. She specialises in the intersection of philosophy of mind, neuroscience and cognitive science. How is it in your work that you define mind itself?
Rather than trying to give a dictionary-like definition, I think of the mind as a kind of target of inquiry. So there are a bunch of phenomena that we're interested in, like the way that we experience the world and ourselves and interesting behavioral and cognitive capacities, both in humans and non-human animals. And I think of that as the target, like the things that we're trying to explain, the things that we're interested in, things like memory or communication or perception or, you know, appropriate behavior to the conditions that you find yourself in. And like that cluster of things, I think of as the mind.
How can that be differentiated from consciousness? Because obviously your mind still has attributes of unconscious processing. So for people that aren't so clear on the specific distinction between, obviously mind is something that's been attributed more to psychology than the actual complete study of consciousness. So how is it that we can talk about the unconscious mind?
We probably know more about the unconscious mind in a systematic scientific way than we do about the conscious mind, because we can study the unconscious processes of mind in animals, in anesthetized animals. We can study them more easily than we can conscious experience, which it seems like we only have access to through our own personal experience and by, you know, verbal reports from other people. It's much harder to study systematically. I guess more generally, I think of mind as the broader thing, and like one of the maybe the most mysterious and puzzling aspect of the mind is consciousness. So conscious experience is just one of the members of this cluster of interesting phenomena we're interested in.
So what you're essentially saying is that mind is the macro version that also includes consciousness as part of its remit. So is there any ways that you would differentiate between the study of consciousness and the study of mind?
Yeah, I think the study of mind is more general.
But you're still interested in phenomena like qualia and this kind of stuff?
I'm actually not that interested in things like qualia, because I think that, you know, as far as the philosophical work does, a lot of the most interesting things happened, you know, 20, 30 years ago. You know, there are great philosophers who worked on that stuff and basically said, you know, covered the bases, said the things that there were to say about it. And it's not clear what the next steps are. Thinking more about that might involve taking steps backwards rather than forwards.
Do you actually think the hard problem is actually a problem at all?
I think the hard problem is not a scientific problem. I think that people who are fascinated by the hard problem are expressing their commitment to a notion of the mind that sort of by construction defies scientific explanation.
I think I agree with certain positions of that. So is it fair to say you'd be slightly more in the Daniel Dennett camp than David Chalmers?
Absolutely.
Okay, perfect. Got that one out of the way. Okay, excellent. So you've defined the mind and how it's differentiated from particular studies regarding consciousness. So how do you think is the best way to represent the mind, and what are some of the issues you've got to grapple with when we're coming up with a scientific theory that best represents this collection of mental phenomena, which is the mind?
So when you say represent the mind, do you mean something like how do we best describe the phenomena we're interested in?
Yeah.
So I think most often by building models. So lots of different kinds of models from different perspectives. So one thing you might try to do is build a model of a particular task that you might be interested in. Right? So there are certain things that we're really good at doing, like making decisions under uncertainty and trying to, you know, maximize the payoff from some kind of situation. Another thing we're really good at is like recognizing objects in the visual world. So if you think of those as things that it takes a sophisticated brain or a mind to do, then we can build models of how we might do that at different levels of specificity. Right, like we might build computational level models, or we might build neuroscientific level models involving physiology and brain wiring, things like that.
For you, the best way to represent the mind is to represent it with scientific models.
Sorry, I wouldn't quite say that.
Go ahead. How would you best describe it?
I mean, I think we're interested in the mind from a bunch of different perspectives. So like another perspective where people do build something like models, although maybe they're not called that, are sort of humanistic explorations of what it's like to do moral decision-making. Sorry, I shouldn't say what it's like, but humanistic models of moral decision-making or like intentional action, like those are other ways of getting at the same problem.
And those just tend to involve less scientific models?
Yeah, I think they involve, you know, being sensitive to our experience and the way that we actually do things, but they don't interface directly with scientific models.
The other end of the spectrum would be they're still not kind of grappling with this issue of a hard problem, because you can't really use the hard problem to model anything scientifically, but at least using these humanistic notions of intentionality and direction is still better than the other end of the spectrum, which is kind of constructing a problem of mind from the hard problem.
Yeah, I don't think of the hard problem as a way of trying to explain things. It seems more like a way of saying we can't explain things.
So you'd rather take the humanistic approach, which might involve intentionality, even though that might not be as amenable to scientific models, but it's still better as an explanatory tool.
Yeah, and I think one of the explanatory tools that's sort of shared across a bunch of different domains is this notion of representation. And that's really like the core of what I'm interested in, because you can find, you know, neuroscientists using the notion of representation and psychologists, but also philosophers. And sometimes it seems like they mean things, there's something in common in what they're saying, because it seems quite different. And I think figuring that out is a good way of seeing what the different perspectives have to offer when it comes to explaining the things we're interested in.
So if you could, in terms of the different ways we can represent mind, from your experience, your work and research, from your own perspective, what would you say are some of the best ways to represent mind and some of the not so good ways to represent mind from many different fields?
So I think some of the most interesting work in neuroscience has to do with these investigations into reward-based decision making. There were these pretty famous series of papers that came out in the late 90s and early 2000s about the ventral tegmental area dopaminergic system, where people found these neurons that were sensitive to the predicted reward value of some stimulus in monkeys. And when they measured the activity of these neurons, it seemed like they were following a pattern of activity during the performance of the task that was very similar to the values that you would expect based on a model of temporal difference learning, which had been in the psychology and artificial intelligence literature. That was like a nice piece of contact between thinking about just how you would solve a task, sort of from first principles, and finding a mechanism that could plausibly be doing that in the brain. So I think that was one case where it was like, we have found a representation for reward prediction error in the brain. Now we can explain how it is that these monkeys are able to do this task.
Is an example of a bad way to represent the mind that you've come across? I'm sure there's probably quite a few. Would you just give us a whole spectrum of collection of arguments? That was a good one that you mentioned. What would be a slightly more negative way to represent the mind?
Do you mean a model that I think doesn't work well?
Yes, essentially.
I guess there are these sort of notorious examples from the early days of artificial intelligence that weren't very successful, where we try to model the mind by putting in these sentences and then these sort of rules of how you get from one sentence to another, where you try to do sort of top-down, like high-level inference or language processing. And it turned out that like just having that high-level stuff using sort of intuitive rules didn't work that well for generating the kinds of responses that humans generate. I think I'm still not completely clear on what you mean by representing the mind. So
what are the limitations of just using purely scientific models to represent the mind? You obviously noted some humanistic motivations that we could talk about, like intentions to represent the mind, but are there any other specific limitations when we're trying to represent the mind?
Maybe it's all limitations. So I think as soon as you try to study some particular aspect of the mind that maybe we're familiar with from, you know, our own experience from everyday life, we have to operationalize it in some way. We have to figure out like what measurable things we're going to use as proxies for the thing that we're, you know, really interested in. And as soon as you've done that, sort of, you've pared away some of the richness of the thing that you're originally studying in exchange for being able to study it systematically. So if you were interested in, one of my friends is working on this paper on nostalgia, for example, right? If that was something that you were interested in and you had introspected your own nostalgic experiences, maybe you're an immigrant and you came from somewhere else, you've looked at how it's represented in the literature, and now you want to study nostalgia in the lab. You want to do imaging experiments and see like what's going on in people's brains when they feel nostalgia. You have to come up with some criterion of what counts as nostalgia, like which things we're going to measure, because we can't measure everything. And then at the end, maybe what you've come up with an explanation of is not so much nostalgia, but, you know, one certain aspect of memory that might be associated with certain kinds of feelings that result in responses that people give to a certain questionnaire. So you sort of reduce the thing that you're studying to something that's tracking, but isn't the thing that you care about directly.
Fundamentally, you're saying that the problems that we face in terms of scientific representation of the mind is quite generic in terms of any limitations that we have in any scientific research program. So it's obviously defining your terms, defining your concepts, and then obviously operationalizing those terms and concepts. So you might get specific clarity with a definition, but you might lose the substance of the phenomena you're trying to study. So it's quite general in this respect.
I don't think it's entirely general, because I think it is specific to the mind. So we also do this in biology, and we also do this in physics and chemistry and so forth. But there, it doesn't seem like there's as much of a gap between the thing that originally got us interested. There's not as huge a mismatch between the manifest image and the scientific image in those domains.
Is this little gap the opportunity that people pounce upon when they try to say that science and the brain alone can't explain mind? Is this an area that gives them an opportunity because of this ambiguity?
I don't think it's ambiguity exactly, but I think they're right. What we mean when we say mind is not just this collection of things that we can measure. We mean something more, and part of what we mean by it is this like central part of, you know, we have experiences, qualitative experiences. We have sort of introspective access to some things that are going on, and those aren't things that we study scientifically for the most part. And when we do study them scientifically, we don't really seem to be getting at the core of it.
Thanks for that, Rosa. What's your future work? I mean, what kind of issues are you going to be working on?
I'm interested in sort of informational explanations of the mind and of the brain. And I think they're really interesting because part of the appeal of an informational explanation is that it seems like it gives you the best of both worlds. So on the one hand, you get to hang on to this idea that there's a difference between like the physical brain, mm-hmm. which is the squishy thing, and all the amazing things that it can do, which are kind of informational and representational and can be abstracted away from the actual messy biological details. So on the one hand, you have that. And on the other hand, it's still a scientifically respectable concept. Like, physicists use it, mm-hmm. computer scientists use it, and it seems like we can do work with it in a way that we couldn't with, you know, intentionality or some other earlier dualistic conceptions. So that's a very powerful concept, but again, it's used in lots of different ways, and I'm interested in seeing like what role this notion of information actually plays in different kinds of models of how the mind works.
If I could just get you to explain why informational theory itself is better than something that intentionality in terms of keeping like the separate bit, like the brain, a squishy thing, and producing the mind. Why is it better specifically from something to do with intention? Because
so all I mean by that is if you were a Descartes, or if you were someone from the 19th century, if you're a sort of naive dualist, you might think that, sorry, I'm not saying that dualists aren't naive, I'm saying if you were you might think the reason the mind gets to do all these unusual and special things is because there is some non-material basis for it, and that accounts for the specialness, but then we don't know what to do next because, you know, we don't have a way of systematically dealing with this non-material aspect of it except in our own experience, which is not a super systematic way of studying anything. So in that way, it's less good than something like a well-worked out theory of information where it seems like, or at least it sounds like, people know what they're talking about when they talk about information processing and what information is in one brain area versus another, and how a system might exploit information to perform some task. One of those seems more tractable, especially when you look at, you know, all the recent advances in artificial intelligence, where it seems like people are using exactly those terms and making a lot of progress.
In terms of using information theory in a study of mind, can that solely be explained by the computational model of mind, i.e. that it's just software that's just run on hardware? Is there another way we could explain information in the mind and brain without a computational model?
Right. I think that those two ideas often go hand in hand. Information processing just is computation. Some people don't think that that's true, that they think that, you know, computation involves something more, mm-hmm. Something more specific having to do with a particular kind of systematic architecture, whereas information processing just requires being sensitive to certain relational facts between what's going on in some part of your brain and what's going on outside in the world. I also wouldn't put it in terms of information theory, because that's something else that's quite specific, that it's like part of engineering and communications. Yeah. It isn't exactly what people are relying on when they give sort of information or computation-based theories of brain activity, for example. The other thing I would say is that the computational theory of mind means something quite specific in philosophy. And I think it's like that conception of computation and the mind is, I think, pretty different from the notion of computation that a computational neuroscientist, for example, or a psychologist might be appealing to. This traditional conception of like the computational theory of mind from, say, Fodor, it's the idea that there are representations in the mind and computation is the manipulation of those representations in order to produce other representations, and like that explains the workings of the mind. I think that when a lot of scientists talk about neural computation or computation in the brain, they have a much thinner notion of computation that doesn't really rely on rich representations, but rather is just a way of saying these are the things that the cells are doing described mathematically. So we might talk about, you know, computation is the circuit performing. You know, it's predicting where the, you know, next stimulus is going to be. But that prediction just means something like firing in anticipation of when that stimulus happens, and not anything like having a representation that there is some event in the world out there.
Are there any papers you're working on, or any books at the moment?
I'm working on some papers on the neural code and predictive coding. So how can we translate between things that we can measure the brain doing and what we think it's doing it for, and how we should best interpret what it's doing in light of the capacities that the system as a whole is displaying.